You're listening to the opening strains of HaTikvah, the Hope, the Israeli National Anthem. I'm Larry Mantle. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Today we're talking about the 60th anniversary of the Nation of Israel, a time when the country is looking at its past and better focusing on its founders and what the ideals were for the establishment of the State of Israel and what life is like in the country today, where there are gaps between the ideals and the reality and other places where the nation has evolved according to the visions of at least some of its founders. We're joined first by Jacob Dayan, who is Consul General for the Nation of Israel. He's based here in Los Angeles. Consul General Dayan, thank you for being with us.
Good morning, and thank you for celebrating with us our 60th anniversary.
We appreciate your being with us. Now, can you share with us, first of all, in Israel itself, how big is this anniversary?
It's a huge celebration. We are going to have presidents from all over the world. President Bush is arriving to Israel and many other presidents. It's going to be a huge, huge celebration. We already started this celebration. Actually, it's kind of an emotional week for us because we move from the Holocaust Day to the, which we remember, the 6 million, to the Independence Day. So it's a big emotional week, and the celebrations are going to be huge.
As you look at the founding ideals of Israel, what do you think has been accomplished that the founders envisioned for the country, and what are the ways in which you feel the vision hasn't yet been realized?
I think that first we have to remind ourselves that we are celebrating basically our 3,060th anniversary, not our 60th anniversary, because if we are looking on our founders, so where we have to go back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs. But basically, I think we can look with a lot of satisfactions on what we have achieved in 60 years. If I tell people that when they use their cell phones, they use Israel. When they use their computers, they use Israel. Israel is the number one country in the United States in numbers of patents listed, more than China, India, and Russia together. In terms of medical devices, so many medical devices, so many innovations. So I think that the ideal of bringing the Jewish people to its homeland was partially established, because in 1948 there were 600,000 Jews. Now you have more than 6 million Jews. The majority of Jews today live in the State of Israel. Once it was not the case. I think that 60 years ago Israel was fighting for its own survival, which now Israel is strong and prospering. It's the most prospering economy in the Western world in the last 4 years, more than 5% growth each year. So there is a lot of satisfaction, but still we have a lot to achieve and a lot to work. We would like and we aspire to achieve peace with our neighbors, and this is a goal that still has to be achieved. It has been achieved with Egypt and with Jordan and relatively with other countries, but still we have to aspire for more.
We're speaking with the Consul General for Israel in Los Angeles, Jacob Dayan. For many Americans, I think, they think of the establishment of Israel as a response to the Holocaust, that there would be a nation created that would be a safe haven for Jews who weren't just killed, 6 million in numbers during the Holocaust era, but have historically been scapegoated in many different countries in which Jews have been a minority. But the concept of Zionism and the call for establishment of Israel, of course, predates the Holocaust. And I wonder if you could speak to this issue of the idea of Israel itself.
Absolutely. And you know, you remind me, I actually referred to that in my Holocaust speech when I spoke to that, because I said that those who deny the existence of the Jewish state are wrong to think that the Jewish state was established as a result of the Holocaust. When they invalidate the Holocaust, so in doing so, they think that they invalidate the reason of for the existence of the Jewish state. However, the Jewish state exists not because of the Holocaust. It is the realization of the Jewish people's natural right to live as a free nation in its land. And the land that we have been living, actually, as I said, 3,060 years ago, or years, that the Holocaust simply emphasized the need to establish it. The whole Zionistic movement started, as you say correctly, with Herzl in the 19th century. And today also, you are celebrating Harry Truman's birthday, May 8th. And he was the American president that decided to recognize the state of Israel. So we have some kind of a joint celebration today in that. But this is the realization of the Zionistic dream, which started much, much before the Holocaust.
We're speaking with Consul General of Israel in Los Angeles, Jacob Dayan. Also with us in this one-hour conversation on Israel's 60th anniversary is Carolyn O'Hara, senior editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, which has done a large piece on a number of myths that have to do with Israel. Gershom Gorenberg writing that particular piece, the magazine looking at Israel six decades after its founding. We thank you, Ms. O'Hara, for joining us on Air Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk first about Zionism itself. What is Zionism?
Well, Zionism is, you know, a political ideology, this idea that there should be a home for the Jews. And like you said earlier in the segment, it's something that definitely predates the birth of Israel. This cover story that we have in the magazine in Foreign Policy this time around by Gershom Gorenberg is really fascinating because, you know, you can talk about the ideals of Zionism and you can talk about how they're actually played out in the modern manifestation of Israel and looking back at the past 60 years. And you can definitely see how there are some kind of inherent contradictions about what its founders had as its ideal and what it actually turned out to be.
And what was the diversity among Israel's founders, because even with the United States founding, the founding fathers had a wide range of disagreements about what the U.S. government, for example, should look like.
Oh, absolutely. I think Zionism is very heavily tinged with socialist ideals, and I think when you look at Israel today, I don't think you necessarily socialism is not something that comes to mind. As you were saying previously, I mean, this is a place that is highly successful capitalist society. It's one of the world leaders in high tech innovation. It is, again, one of those interesting kind of trajectories that a state takes, departing from, the idea that its founders might have had.
And I guess I think of the kibbutz as kind of the prime example of that socialist vision, the collective farm.
Absolutely, absolutely. And those are, those are one thing that remain highly successful institutions in the modern state.
Well, what about Israel as a democracy? It is the lone democracy that you would say is, there in the Middle East. But the government has been having some struggles lately, and particularly with the alignment of the parties and decision making. So what are the pros and cons of Israel's form of democracy?
It's one of the primary kind of myths of Israel that Gershom Gorenberg addresses in this piece for us for Foreign Policy. You can't knock the fact that Israel is, in very many ways, a successful democracy, and we should, we should honor the fact that it remains, a successful democracy in a neighborhood that lacks democracy in many places. But that said, there are some very critical weaknesses. I mean, there is a 1/5 of the population, the Arab minority, that they officially have equal rights, but they're scarce, they're not necessarily put into practice all the time. They're not present in the civil service. And I think there are issues with the fact that there's a lack of a formal constitution. We're also talking about a successful democracy, but it lacks formal borders. The main parties are kind of crumbling right now. I mean, Kadima was the centrist party, was founded a couple of years ago, primarily to get out of the rut of left and right infighting. The three main parties, Likud, Labor, and Kadima, I think have something less than half of the seats in the Knesset today. So you have to ask yourself, where is it going? At the very least, I think Israeli politics needs an infusion of new blood. And you can't look at the newspapers in Israel today, you know, when you're celebrating your 60th anniversary and your prime minister is having a fairly intense kind of bribery corruption scandal.
What was it like in 48 with the government? Did you have the two dominant parties and the others were fringe at that point? Or what did it look like then compared to now?
I mean, I think it was somewhat chaotic. I mean, this was a state that was really just trying to preserve its existence. I mean, as soon as it was founded, it was attacked by, you know, all of its surrounding neighbors. At the very least, it wasn't so much right versus left. It was just the fact of survival and reasserting that existence.
Jacob Dayan, Consul General of Israel in Los Angeles, your thoughts about the fact that, you know, Israel, with its democracy, has had a tough time representing Arabs in Israel, and also the lack of a written constitution being an issue?
I would say this first. It's important to know that the Arab minority is completely represented in the parliament, in the Israeli Knesset. I mean, they have 12 parliament members. They can vote as anyone else. And actually, that's a privilege in other respects. They don't have some of the obligations. For example, they don't have to serve for at least 3 years in the army. And we should remember that as well. But still, we have to improve some things there, I do agree. But at the same time, in the parliament and in the Knesset, they are totally represented. And actually, they have even parliament members in the big parties in Israel, in all the three parties in Israel, in Kadima, in the Likud, and in the Labor Party. They have representatives. So it's not only that they have their own parties, but they are represented in the bigger parties.
Real quickly on the constitution issue. Why no written constitution for Israel?
This is an historical thing. I mean, when Israel was established, the whole situation was, as Ms. O'Hara mentioned, was very chaotic. And to establish and to form a constitution was something which was relatively impossible. There was the Declaration of Independence, which is kind of the vision and what should be done there.
Okay. Okay, hold that thought, please, Mr. Dayan, Jacob Dayan, Consul General of Israel in Los Angeles. We'll come back and talk more about that issue, the founding of Israel versus today, 60 years later. This is Air Talk on KPCC.
Support for KPCC is provided by the Getzman Group, assisting businesses with financial and accounting project professionals through people, knowledge, and commitment. Online at GOETZMANGroup.com.
Good morning. It's 19 minutes past 11. I'm Deborah Baer in for Hedy Lyn Herdes. This is 89.3 KPCC. City Council members now want a review of Los Angeles International Airport's contracting process. There's controversy over who got redesigned contracts and why. More on the story from KPCC's Brooke Binkowski.
The agency that runs the airport is fielding fallout for two contracts involving its high-profile redesign. Critics say the company rushed into multi-million dollar contracts with Fentress Architects and DMJM Aviation. The LA City Council and City Controller's Office is looking into whether Los Angeles World Airport's executive director improperly steered the contracts to companies she preferred after advisors recommended other firms. She denies doing anything improper. Members of the City Council say LA Airport's officials also need to better explain the project bidding process to competing firms. The city attorneys and city controller's offices plan to report back to the City Council next month with recommendations on ways to make the process more transparent. Brooke Binkowski, 89.3 KPCC.
You can help restore forests destroyed by wildfires by contributing to KPCC. For just $10 a month, we'll plant 10 trees to say thank you. If you'd like to honor a friend or family member with your contribution, let us know and we'll list their name on our website. Help keep forests growing and public radio strong by contributing online today at kpcc.org. Thank you. Cloudy skies in the LA metro area today with some clearing, a high around 71 degrees.
great Miles Davis performing Israel. It's the 60th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. We have a variety of guests with us this hour to talk about what the ideals were behind the nation's founding and how much that is aligned with or not aligned with the present-day Israel. We're at 866-893-KPCC. I'd also be interested in your thoughts on this as you weigh in on Israel six decades later. We're with Consul General of Israel, Jacob Dayan, who's based in Los Angeles, Carolyn O'Hara, Senior Editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, the cover devoted to the 60th anniversary of Israel. Consul General Dayan, you're talking about the Constitution and the chaotic nature of the founding of the country and its declaration of independence, having the ideals for Israel. Has there been a call for a constitutional convention in Israel?
Yes. Actually, now there is a whole committee in the parliament, in the Knesset, that is working on forming some kind of constitution, or some kind of agreed constitution between the whole parties and partners that are relevant, and they're still working on that. In the meantime, what was done is basically they accumulated laws that were enacted by or that were performed by the High Court of Justice, and there are, I would say, some of the pillars that we use in order to form this kind of constitution. But there is a whole work now in order to form some kind of a constitution, yes.
All right. And Carolyn O'Hara, back to you. One of the other issues that's raised in the cover story in Foreign Policy is the concept of a Jewish state. We mentioned earlier that there's this Arab minority, but also you've got variation among Jews themselves with secular Jews, who, as I understand it, was essentially what the founders of Israel were, and then, of course, highly religious all the way to the ultra-Orthodox of Israel.
Mm-hmm. I think Gorenberg argues that, you know, when you say the notion of a Jewish state, you tend to equate it with kind of a religious category, like Catholicism, like you would say that you're a Catholic, like you're a Muslim. And instead, he argues that Israel's founders and in Zionism, it's really more of kind of an ethnic category. And when people say that they live in a Jewish state, it's you know, you can be a secular Jew, and there are just these kinds of these ideas that are really that we would find much more similar to something like a national project rather than something like a religious project.
So not a theocracy, so to speak.
Precisely.
But where you've got a cultural affinity that's passed on mother to child.
Absolutely. And the existence of the state and the reason for that state being is very wrapped up in Jewish ideals. But, again, it's much more of kind of a national project. And you have to remember that, you know, when Israel was founded, it was a very poor, kind of agrarian society, lots of immigrants and Jews coming in from all over the world. And today, you know, it does reflect that. It is a highly diverse society in many ways, with Jews from all over the world, but with, you know, a significant minority of Christians, of Druze, of Arab Muslims. So in that sense, when you say it's a Jewish state, you really have to think about what that actually means.
Would the founders of Israel be surprised by how many religious people there are in Israel now?
Oh, I'm sure. You know, and I, you know, who wants to put words into their mouths? But I think absolutely. I think that I think, like we're saying, I think Israel today is, who could have imagined that it would be the successful democracy that it is, the economically successful country that it is. And, you know, I think that its founders would be much more concerned about the security of this country in this neighborhood. And I think that is one thing that they would feel probably more confident about, and they would be surprised at how secure Israel is in that neighborhood. Because if you looked at it in 1948, it looked like its future was very, very uncertain.
Let me bring into the conversation, as we talk about Judaism within Israel, Daniel Gordis, who's at the Shalom Center in Jerusalem. He was the founding dean of the Ziegler Rabbinical School at the University of Judaism here in Los Angeles. He's written many books on Jewish thought and currents in Israel. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Share with us how this plays out, the issue of religion versus ethnicity versus culture and what it means to be Jewish in Israel.
Well, it means to be very much like it means to be Jewish anywhere else in the world, which is that there have always been many different varieties of Jewish interpretation and Jewish kinds of involvement. And Jews in Israel span the entire spectrum, from, as you said before, people from the Orthodox community, the ultra-Orthodox community, to people who are entirely secular. It takes on a different level of valence, though, in Israel, because whereas in the diaspora in North America or in Western Europe, if Jews want to simply opt out, they certainly have that option. In Israel, if people want to opt out, they have to begin to ask themselves why they're sticking it out in a country which, as some of your people have already mentioned this evening, is this morning, where you are, I guess, it's a very dangerous neighborhood here. And so I think Israelis are in a very searching mode. Israelis are asking themselves, what does it mean to combine nationalism with ethnicity and with religion? And while it's true that most people describe Israel as a culture radically divided between orthodoxy on the one hand and secular liberalism on the other, the reality of Israel's life is much more complex and much more nuanced. There are many, many indications across Israeli society that young Israelis in their 20s and 30s are seeking some sort of re-engagement with their Jewish spiritual, religious heritage. It does not mean they're becoming observant. It certainly doesn't mean they're becoming Orthodox. But it does mean that many of them are finding the radical secularism of labor Zionism to be somewhat empty. So I think that even on the religious side, Israel is very complex and nuanced. Some of your other contributors this morning have pointed to the fact that Israel is very complex politically, it's very complex economically, and I think that religiously, socially, and currently, culturally, Israelis are doing no less searching than they are in lots of other arenas.
How did this secular state of Israel on its establishment end up with a rabbinical council that determines that Jews are able to marry or not, and with the codified laws about observance of the Sabbath? It was a secular state. How did that end up part of the law?
That's a good question. It ended up as a law in much the way that many of Israel's laws get made up, which is that it's a compromise between various factions that in order to be able to create a state together, all of them have had to give something. And I think it's really important before proceeding to make it very clear that this is not a Jewish version of Iran. This is not even a Jewish version of Egypt. As some of your listeners are probably aware, there was recently a long piece in the New York Times Magazine about how family courts in Egypt are run according to Sharia, according to Islamic law. Israeli courts are not run according to Jewish law. The only courts in Israel that are run according to Jewish law are the rabbinic courts, which the vast majority of Israelis never have anything to do with. While it is true that there is an Orthodox rabbinate, and while it is true that that Orthodox rabbinate is highly criticized by many people, and I think rightly so in certain cases, it's been pointed out by many people, including Ruth Gavison, for example, a professor of law at Hebrew University, who was one of the heads of the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, a highly secular Jew, that while the reality that you're pointing to is correct, there is an Orthodox rabbinic establishment, it does not touch the lives of most Israelis on a regular basis. But what you're pointing to, for example, the tradition that intercity buses don't run on the Sabbath, and in certain cities, regular buses don't run on the Sabbath, this is a compromise between those people who saw Zionism as a means of fulfilling a religious vision, and those people, on the other hand, who saw Zionism as a means of fulfilling a political vision. Zionism, like any ideology, is really much more than simply a political ideology. For some, it was a religious ideology. For some, it was a social ideology. For some, it was political. All of those factions made their way to the same little piece of land. And in 1948, after the British had pulled out, after the Western world decided, in light of what had happened in Germany and rest of Europe between 1938 and 1945, that it was time to create some Jewish national sovereign entity, all those highly disparate factions had to combine to make one functioning country. And to a very large extent, much of Israel's policy, internally and externally, but here we're talking about internally, has been a product of very difficult compromise between groups who see Zionism and its very purpose very differently, even 60 years later.
Daniel Gordas of the Shalom Center in Jerusalem with us on Air Talk. We are also joined by Paul Sham, who is scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington. He lived in Israel for 8 years, where he worked at the Ministry of Justice, and spent 6 years at the Truman Institute Institute for Peace at Hebrew University. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Glad to join you.
As we're talking about the law, might be good for you as someone who worked at the Ministry of Justice to talk about, you know, how this plays out. Because if you argue that Israel isn't a theocracy, that it is a secular state, it does seem still there are these kinds of compromise, you know, vestiges of this battle that was fought, that was hashed out at the nation's founding.
Well, it's more than vestiges, and it comes up in idiosyncratic ways. While most, as was said, most secular Israelis, except when they are married and die, when they need not come into conflict or any even contact at all with the rabbinical establishment, there are a number of laws that ways in which it impacts people. One of the ones that has the most resonance is the exemption of yeshiva students from serving in the army, and this again was brought in as a compromise when it was first proposed. There were very few. Now the numbers have multiplied tremendously, and Israelis feel that there is a fundamentally unfair aspect of it. But it's something that it is not, though, as was said, in any sense a theocracy, and it should be emphasized that for all, for non-Jews, they don't come into it, into contact with the religious aspects. There are separate courts for each of them. The only people who have a real problem are those who would like to opt out of a religious denomination, and you can't. There is no civil marriage. A large number of Israelis who do not want to get married by the rabbinate go to Cyprus or elsewhere to be married. So it's a mixed sort of bag, but the ethnicity, the Jewish ethnicity, is what is very much dominant in the state, not so much Jewish religiosity.
So, Paul Sham, give us your sense of, you know, looking at the founders and the different perspectives that they had on the establishment of Israel. What are the various ways they would look at the country 60 years later and critique it?
Well, as was mentioned briefly, the founders of the state in 1948, who were a different group from the Zionist ideologists, in some ways, who Herzl and the people who followed him, they would be astonished to see the degree of income inequality, the absence of socialism. They all saw their socialism as an integral part of their Zionism. And Israel, at least this has been quoted, has the second highest income inequality in the world after the United States. Something else that would astonish them would be the fact that at this point the Palestinian and the Arab population of Israel speaks fluent Hebrew. And they could not imagine that something like that. Israel's place in the world. Israel was originally founded as a refuge, and that people want to get in. That Israel wants to, has to keep people out. There are large that it is kept. The only people who can immigrate for practical purposes are Jews, but that Israel is a major power. But also, I think they would be perhaps most astonished by the fact that the Israel's neighbors are most of them either have treaties or are willing to have treaties, but the Palestinians, who they thought had been basically dispersed and gone, that they have reconstituted themselves into a nation, and they are the main challengers, that Israel accepted in principle a Palestinian state, and that this tension is still going on, is something that they would not have expected, except perhaps for Zev Jabotinsky, the right-wing leader, who warned that the Arabs would never forget.
So often in the United States, people look back and say, you know, what did the founders intend? What were they trying to say in a particular section of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights? And I wondered, is that a part of the debate in Israel today, where people go back and quote people like Ben-Gurion or Herzl, or they cite these kinds of early references as a way of arguing right or wrong what the country's doing today?
Generally not. That seems a very long time ago, and I would say for most people, except the people who bring it up, a Zionist response tend to be the Israeli right and settlers. If there is an attack on them, they consider a Zionist response to build a new settlement in the territories or something like that. But and occasionally people would say that. But that generation is gone, and I think that there's a healthy recognition that Israel has gone off in a trajectory that nobody could have imagined. I would say the other thing that you do, the other people who say that to some degree without bringing up the founders but bringing up the ideals, are those who feel that Israel's policy towards Palestinians especially needs to be modified, and that this is not following the ideals of the founders, even though I think Ben-Gurion would have approved of much of the policy of the last 60 years.
What about settlements and the debate within Israel over settlements, particularly in the West Bank? Is that something that's often framed in historic context?
There, in some ways, as I say, the settlers bring that up. And they say that this is not any different from the secular settling of the land in the 30s and in the first half of the century in what the British Mandate and then what was Israel. So they go back to that, but also their ideology at this point is very much of a mixture. It's a semi-apocalyptic ideology of religious Zionism for the most part. So they bring up the past, but they are more likely to frame it in terms of the what they consider a Jewish mandate to settle the land of Israel.
Paul Sham at the Middle East Institute with us on Air Talk. Lived in Israel for 8 years, where he worked in the Ministry of Justice. We're going to continue our conversation with a number of guests focused on the 60th anniversary of the State of Israel. This is Air Talk on 89.3.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by City of Hope, helping to lead the way in less invasive surgery for lung cancer patients using the Da Vinci robotic system. Guided by skilled surgeons, Da Vinci helps remove tumors precisely for less discomfort and a faster recovery. If you have lung cancer, you can call 800-826-HOPE, or you can ask your doctor for a referral. City of Hope, science saving lives.
This is 89.3 KPCC Southern California Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Deborah Baer with a pair of tickets to give away for this Sunday's Richard P. Wilson New Music Concert featuring cellist Matt Heimovitz. You'll enjoy two world premieres by Christopher Theofanidis and Peter Askim of the Idlewild Arts Academy Orchestra. The performance is this Sunday at 7 o'clock at the Walt Disney Concert Hall Complex in the Red Cat Cal Arts Theater. Tickets are available at Ticketmaster.com and free if you're the third caller to 626-585-7893. Good luck. An elderly woman died at the scene of a house fire in Altadena this morning. She was about 90 years old. County fire officials say they are still investigating the cause of her death and the fire, which was reported just before 10 o'clock on Lincoln Avenue. CSI co-star Gary Dorden has been charged with felony possession of heroin, cocaine, and ecstasy stemming from his arrest last month. The 41-year-old actor was arrested after police found him asleep in his car in Palm Springs, rather, on April 28th. He was allegedly parked on the wrong side of the street with the car's interior light on. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. You can get traffic and weather on our website, kpcc.org.
As Jerusalem of Gold, this is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, the 60th anniversary of the founding of Israel. Jacob Dayan, who is Consul General of Israel in Los Angeles with us. Consul General, I know you have to leave very soon, but I wanted to ask, you've had a chance to hear our other guests, all but one of them so far, weigh in on Israel, the ideals of its establishment versus today's Israel. Is there anything with which you disagree that you've heard so far?
No, listen, I tend to agree, basically. I mean, the forefathers of the State of Israel were Zionists, were basically secular, came from Eastern Europe with the socialist ideas, and this was the vision that they had. And Israel is far from being a socialist country today. It's a highly capitalist country. It's, as I said, it's the fastest growing economy in the Western world. So this is the contradiction between the vision and the realization of the vision.
We thank you very much, Consul General, for being with us and talking about the celebration taking place honoring Israel's anniversary. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Jacob Dayan of Los Angeles. Also with us, Carolyn O'Hara of Foreign Policy Magazine, Paul Sham of the Middle East Institute, Daniel Gordis of the Shalem Center in Jerusalem, and Jeffrey Goldberg, author of Prisoners, A Muslim and a Jew Across the Middle East Divide. He's staff writer for The Atlantic Monthly. The May issue of The Atlantic had the cover story, Is Israel Finished? And included a piece by Jeffrey Goldberg. Thank you, sir, for joining us on Air Talk.
Thanks for having me.
What do you see overall as either the gap or the symmetry between the founding ideals in Israel today?
Well, I think some of your guests have touched on that. The most amazing thing to me is the socialist vision of the founders versus the capitalist reality today. I guess, based on my current preoccupation, which is Israel's future, literal future, its ability to stay an independent Jewish democracy in the Middle East, I think what's interesting, when I cast my mind back to what the founders were thinking, I think they'd probably be amazed and shocked and disheartened to find out that questions are still being asked 60 years after the founding about whether Israel has a permanent place for itself and permanent international legitimacy in the Middle East.
And what was the understanding of the Arab minority within Israel and how that would play out demographically? Was that the subject of debate in those early years?
It was not the yes and no. It wasn't the subject of debate. People were aware of it. There were obviously people, one of your guests mentioned Jabotinsky, who was actually quite far-sighted about the enduring nature of this issue. There was the thought in 1948, of course, that the number of Jews coming into the country would certainly be much greater than the number of Arabs who remained in the country. These questions about demography come up in large part because of the 1967 war in which Israel found itself in possession of the West Bank and Gaza and the Arabs who live in those places, and that is, to me, one of the two, represents one of the two central challenges to the continued existence of the state as a Jewish democracy.
And looking overall, though, at demographic shifts, I mean, it would seem that the more religious Jews within Israel are the ones having larger families, the more conservative ones. So you've got that population on the Jewish side that's growing the most. You've got the growth in the Arab population. So what does that forecast for the future?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is that it's not, from my perspective, it's not all hopeless. I think that that you might start seeing a trend downward in the number of children the ultra-Orthodox families are having, for the simple reason that it's not economically sustainable. You have, on the margins of that subculture, sub-society, some of the leading rabbis saying, well, you know, you guys, the men are going to have to go to work instead of studying in yeshiva all day. On the Arab side is some very interesting numbers. There's some studies that have been done that show that Arab Israeli women who have college degrees have a lower birth rate than Israeli Jewish women who have college degrees. In other words, education is and this is of course a common story around the world. Education is a leading predictor of how many children someone is going to have. And what's interesting about that is that from the Jewish demographic perspective, from the right-wing perspective, people want the number of Jews to remain higher than the number of Arabs. But right-wingers in Israel don't understand that one way to bring that about is to actually enfranchise the Arab population to a degree that it has not been enfranchised. In other words, if better services were provided to the Arab sector, if more education were provided, you would find that Arab families wouldn't be quite so large.
How much of a welfare state within Israel is there for the Arab minority?
Well, you know, on paper, Arab Israelis are due everything that Israeli Jews are due. My general understanding is that the spending, government spending in the Arab sector and Arab villages is roughly 60% or so, maybe as high as 70%, some numbers, of what's happening in the Jewish side. That said, you have to understand that Israel is a welfare state in a way that we don't fully understand. I mean, the poorest Arab in Israel has more of a safety net than a middle class person in California. But nonetheless, there are disparities in the spending, and for reasons that have nothing to do with demography, of course, that should be fixed. Israel is a wealthy country now. And obviously, there can be a lot more work done to bring the Arab enfranchisement to the fore as a social and moral issue.
Jeffrey Goldberg of the Atlantic Monthly with us on Air Talk. Daniel Gordas of the Shalom Center in Jerusalem. Back to you to talk about the religious future of Israel. Where do you see it going, particularly given demography?
I think that what we're likely to see is a much more nuanced rainbow of positions. I think that, as Jeffrey Goldberg was just saying very astutely, the likelihood that the ultra-Orthodox community can continue to sustain itself the way it's going now is very small. It's just economically not viable. If that were to ever be coupled with dramatic political reform in Israel, which would weaken the possibility of smaller parties to have the impact on coalitions that they now have, the position of the ultra-Orthodox community would be further weakened. So I suspect that, not in the immediate future, but over the longer run, we're going to see some sort of diminution of the economic power of it's not a tremendous academic power of force, but it has a tremendous amount of political leverage because of the coalition system. I imagine that the ultra-Orthodox community is going to have to be modernized somewhat. Somebody pointed out, one of your guests, and I apologize for not remembering who it was, pointed out that the ultra-Orthodox community does not participate in military service, just like the Arabs don't. The Arabs don't for one reason. The ultra-Orthodox community are allowed out by virtue of a compromise that was made with Ben-Gurion in the early days of the state. My own sense is that there is increasing resentment among many Israeli segments about that abiding disinterest in supporting the country in that regard. And I have a hunch, it's very hard to prove, but I have a hunch that in the next several decades we're going to see that addressed. And as I said before, I think that even secular Israelis aren't nearly as secular as we imagine. Israelis are very aware of the fact that Zionism on some level makes absolutely no sense without the ability to say something profound and meaningful about what a Jewish society should look like, why the Jews want sovereignty and what the Jews plan to do with sovereignty. Just to become a Hebrew-speaking version of Holland or Belgium, as great as those countries may be, probably does not justify the enormous price that Israelis have to pay to keep this country going. And that has led, I believe, to a real searching on the part of secular Israelis for something new and something deeper. So I think that this radical divide between secular and religious, the problem of the ultra-Orthodox community is probably going to become much more nuanced in the course of the years to come.
Daniel Gordas, how much do you think that Israel and the perception of Israelis as a country under threat is a part of the national identity?
It's an enormous part of the national identity. I think that Israelis are aware, perhaps in ways that they have never been before, that this is still the only country in the international community of nations about which there is still an ongoing debate as to whether it has a right to exist. Whether it's Tony Judt writing in the New York Review of Books, or whether it's Ahmadinejad, and you have to imagine, try to imagine any other member of the General Assembly of Native Nations saying about yet another one that it should not be allowed to exist or that it should be destroyed. Israelis are aware all across the political spectrum, all the way from Iran to the United States, that they are still the subject of an ongoing discussion of whether or not they should have a right to exist. When you couple that fact, again, Israelis are very divided politically, and Israelis are very divided in a whole array of ways. But I think most Israelis would say that they had hoped against hope, even if they were opposed to the disengagement from Gaza in 2005, they had hoped against hope that it might lead to something positive on that front. But it didn't. It led to the election of Hamas. It led to a barrage of Qassams on Sderot and other areas that the Israeli army has been unable to stop. And it's also very hard to remember, but it's still a fact, that Ehud Olmert was elected just about 2 years ago on a platform of getting Israel out of the West Bank. So the Israeli electorate at one point was very inclined to make far-reaching concessions to try to settle the conflict in which Israel has found itself embroiled for the last 60 years. But I think that if Olmert were to fall today, tomorrow, this week, next month, and elections were to be held, the likelihood is that Netanyahu, who is part of the, or somewhat to the right, at least, of Olmert, would be elected. And that would be an indication to a certain extent that Israelis are simply despairing. They may be split left and right. They may think that we should have done this, we should have done that. But at the end of the day, Israelis on their 60th anniversary are, as the Consul General said, celebrating with a tremendous amount of energy on the one hand, but are celebrating under a cloud of wondering whether the combined forces of international discussion about whether Israel should exist, Iran's commitment to the destruction of Israel, and the inability to solve the Palestinian conflict all somehow amount to a challenge that raised the question that Jeffrey Goldberg's article raises, can Israel really survive this?
Daniel Gordas is Senior Fellow and Senior Vice President of the Shalom Center in Jerusalem. Paul Sham of the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., I'd like you to respond to the comments that were just made by Mr. Gordas.
Well, in answer to your question, I agree that the conflict is a part of virtually everything else, but I don't think that Israelis are thinking of it primarily in terms of whether they have a right to exist. I think Israel's existence for 60 years, its economic and military prowess, it is something that's established that. I think that from wildly different premises and political points of view, there is a sense that there has not been a failure on the part of Israel as well as of its neighbors to figure out how to settle the issues with the Palestinians, and that their reconstitution, if you will, as a nation has provided Israel with a dilemma that it hasn't been able to deal with. So that conflict and is something that people are not obsessed about. The last time I was in Israel a few months ago, I was surprised. Well, I found very strongly people did not want to talk about the conflict, but it was in the background. And the question, the tension between, on the one hand, that there is an Arab peace initiative that's out there that all of the members of the Arab League agreed to have full diplomatic relations in return for complete withdrawal from the territories, rollback from the 67 war. This would have been something that in 1967 would have been a dream come true. On the one hand, a good part of the nation believes that that's possible. On the other hand, you have the part of the nation that believes that the world, and the Arab world especially, will always hate Israel, and some of them, Ezra, who are religious, believe that Israel has no right to give up any part of Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, while others believe that even if they did give it up, it would make no difference. So there is given the weak government at this point, given the lack of progress on any sort of peace front, most people, and I agree, believe that the current Annapolis process is not leading anywhere.
Okay.
There's a sense of confusion.
Paul Sham of the Middle East Institute with us. I want to go back to senior editor at Foreign Policy magazine, Carolyn O'Hara, because the cover story for that magazine looks at Israel 60 years after its finding. And on this issue of Israel and the perception that it's a nation under threat, the author of the article in Foreign Policy takes issue with that.
I think that's right. I think, and I'd echo, everyone on this panel when you talk about the fact that there continues to be a great deal of anxiety in Israel about its existence and the future of its existence. But this is a place, where the past is always relevant to the future. And I think, two of the things that Israelis have a great deal of anxiety about are the demographic issue and the security issue. But I think Gershom Gorenberg, argues in this piece, this is a country that is the military power in the Middle East. It is it's the nuclear power, and we can talk about the threat of an Iranian bomb and whether an Iranian bomb would mean the annihilation of Israel. And I think what Gorenberg argues is that of course Iran getting the bomb is not going to be good for Israel, but does it mean that the Ayatollahs are going to have their finger on the button the first moment they get it? And he argues that, like many leaders, there's going to be a good deal of pragmatism, that in some cases, the detente that kind of worked between Russia and the United States during the Cold War is obviously not the most ideal of circumstances, but it likely does not mean that Israel will be wiped off the face of the earth, despite Ahmadinejad's ridiculous threats. I think that the threat there is that the Middle East, Iran getting the bomb would trigger a Middle East arms race, and that obviously is not something that anyone wants. But I think that 60 years after its founding, we have to recognize the fact that Israel has actually staked peace agreements with several of its neighbors. It's the military power of the Middle East. In fact, its security looks stronger than ever.
Carolyn O'Hara, Foreign Policy Magazine. Thank you. Paul Sham of the Middle East Institute, Daniel Gordas of the Shalem Center, Jeffrey Goldberg of the Atlantic Monthly, and our thanks earlier, Consul General of Israel Jacob Dayan with us this afternoon on Pat Morrison at 1. More conversation on the 60th anniversary of Israel.